Welcome back to our study of the Law of Moses. Now, that is the last time that you will hear me say those words. This is our final session to cap off the entire study that we started, nearly 2 years ago. Next week, we're going to start putting our knowledge of the law to good use as we begin studying the book of Hebrews, and this will also serve as a way for us to consider how the New Testament and how Christians in the first century treated the law. And to help us answer that question, what place does the law hold in our lives today? Right, so for all of this study, what's the relevance of it? We'll be addressing that question in pretty great detail as we go through our study of Hebrews. For now, we're going to cap everything off by looking at the way that justice was enforced under the law of Moses and in the ancient Near East in general. All right, so we've been given all of these laws, have been given all of these rules. How is all of this enforced, right? The rubber hits the road kind of stuff. Let's start with a couple of examples from before the law of Moses. The first one is one that we looked at last week, the case of Joseph and Potiphar's wife. Now remember that the actual crime was attempted rape. So Potiphar's wife attempts to rape Joseph. She starts off by trying to seduce him, but when he refused, she seized him, which is, as we saw elsewhere in the law, the language of rape. And so Joseph runs away, leaving his cloak behind in her hand. But of course, we know that Joseph is the one who ends up in prison for attempting to rape Potiphar's wife. Why is that? What does Potiphar's wife have against Joseph? Meaning, like, what does she have on Joseph so that the legal system of Egypt in that day would send him to prison instead of sending her to prison? She has three things that she brings out. She brings his cloak. She, more importantly, brings her outcry, but most important of all, her status. Right, the evidence, such as it is faked. Right, he's run off and left the cloak behind. It's not really material evidence that he has attempted to rape her. It's not an indication that he was stripping or anything. She uses it in that way, right? But it doesn't demonstrate anything. Her outcry is false witness. And this speaks to the importance of witness testimony, which we'll turn our attention to later on in our study. But what really seals the deal is her status relative to Joseph's status. She is the master's wife, and Joseph is a slave. And in antiquity, her word means more than his. Right, we talk today about a situation that is a he said, she said. And we talk about the importance of having a report, an outcry made. And the idea, at least in modern times, the idea is that we're supposed to have an equal voice before the law. In antiquity, in much of the ancient world, justice, such as it was explicitly skewed in favor of higher status people. Now, even though we've just said that in modernity we're supposed to all have an equal voice, the way things worked in antiquity should sadly make some intuitive sense to us. Because even today, we should understand just how difficult it can be to have justice done when your adversary is higher status than you. Right? Even though our laws formally are supposed to provide equal treatment, right? That's one of the big principles that we're built on, is equal treatment under the law. And yet we have plenty of modern examples of, well, I mean, it's almost like a proverb, a modern proverb about how rich people can buy their way out of anything. It's a trope that finds its way into all kinds of stories, how rich and powerful people keep getting away with stuff over and over again. And we've seen that laid bare in all kinds of very recent stories. Harvey Weinstein and the whole Me Too movement, we've seen it with Jeffrey Epstein, We've seen all of these indications that wealthy, powerful people can get away with stuff that, you know, that us little folks can't, right? And of course, we've also, you know, all heard horror stories about, you know, when grandma gets into the crosshairs of some really rich guy or some mega corporation. You know, you hear stories about Mark Zuckerberg essentially waging war against people living along some beach in Hawaii because he wants their property. You know, stories about eminent domain where the state comes in and takes, you know, your ancestral home that's been in the family for, you know, 50 generations or whatever, and pays you 10 cents on the dollar for it. All kinds of examples in the modern world of justice being handed out according to status. Well, we have tons of examples in antiquity of just that kind of thing happening, how status worked to give people the upper hand in the justice system. We're going to stick to the Joseph story, though, because we see status and false witness feature importantly in Joseph's story repeatedly, not just here in the episode with Potiphar's wife, but throughout the entire story. In fact, it goes all the way back to the beginning of Joseph's story in Genesis chapter 37. Moses tells us at the very beginning that Joseph is Jacob's favorite son. And he tells us that immediately after, or in the very next sentence after telling us that Joseph has brought a malicious report against his brothers. Now, we're not told what the immediate consequences are there for his brothers, but it's clear in this circumstance that Joseph is successful. He's able to bring this malicious report, and it's believed because he has the status of favorite son in his father's eyes. And so the long-term result is that Joseph's brothers all hate him, so much so that they consider murdering him and end up, as a step down from murder, selling him off into slavery. But again, we get this mix of status and false report right out of the gate in Joseph's story. And then we get that same mix in the episode with Potiphar's wife in Genesis 39. But then we see it again starting in Genesis chapter 42, verses 6 through 17. And let's turn there together and read. Now Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. "Where did you come from?" he said. They said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them, and he said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." And they said to him, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We're all sons of one man. We're honest men. Your servants have never been spies." He said to them, "No, it is the nakedness of the land that you have come to see." And they said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more." But Joseph said to them, "It is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested whether there is truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." And he put them all together in custody for 3 days. Now, Moses starts this part of the story by reminding us of Joseph's status. Now, Joseph was governor over the land. Now, we already know that from the previous chapter. Right? We've seen Joseph's time in prison. We've seen the visions. We've seen how he's been pulled out and set before Pharaoh and interprets visions for Pharaoh, and how Pharaoh sets him over all the land. So we know already that Joseph is second in command over all Egypt, behind only Pharaoh. But Moses reminds us there in verse 6, now Joseph was governor over the land. He reminds us here because it's important for our understanding of what happens over the rest of the passage. Because Joseph recognizes his brothers, but they don't recognize him. And so his status over them is preserved. He is a lord of Egypt. In fact, they address him as Lord. And Joseph remembers his dreams. So he accuses them of being spies. Now, what evidence does he have for this? He doesn't have a shred of evidence for it. He has no reason at all to say this. And they, of course, they object. They start offering up all of this evidence that they can't be spies. No, we're all brothers. Right? We're not some band of mercenaries who's come together. We all have one father. Right? We've got a little brother who's left back behind at home. We're all starving. Right? We've got a brother who's dead. Right? And they're spilling their guts to Joseph, trying to prove their character, that they are not spies. And in the end, what does Joseph say to them? But Joseph said to them, "It is as I said to you." I don't know if your parents ever pulled this on you whenever you were a kid, or if you've ever done this with your own kids, but have you ever had a situation where you've just had to tell them, "It's this way because I say so"? Right? They want to argue with you about something. That's essentially what Joseph has just pulled with his brothers. Right? You're spies because I said so. And there's nothing that they can do for it. They can offer all the evidence in the world, and there's not a thing that they can do about it. And what ends up happening? Even though there's not a shred of evidence that they are spies, the brothers end up in custody. And why do they end up in custody? It is solely because of the difference in status. That's it. That's all there is to it. Joseph is an Egyptian lord, and the brothers are foreigners. And everything happens solely on that basis. And the entire drama that unfolds over the course of chapter 42, chapter 43, chapter 44, all of it comes back to this event, that Joseph was able to accuse them of whatever he wanted to because of that difference in status, just like he was able to do when they were kids. Now, this whole drama that starts here in Genesis 42 reaches its climax when Joseph plants his divining cup in Benjamin's bag and starts to accuse him of stealing it. Let's read the first five verses of Genesis 44. "Then he, that is Joseph, commanded the steward of his house, 'Fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack, and put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, with his money for the grain.' And he did as Joseph told him. As soon as the morning was light, the men were sent away with their donkeys. They had gone only a short distance from the city. Now Joseph said to his steward, 'Up, follow after the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, "Why have you repaid evil for good? Is it not from this that my lord drinks, and by this that he practices divination? You have done evil in doing this.'" Now, the irony is laid on super thick here, because where else have we seen phony evidence planted and a false charge brought in the Joseph story? Of course, this is supposed to bring to mind the episode with Potiphar's wife. And what Potiphar's wife did to Joseph, now Joseph is doing to Benjamin, planting evidence and bringing a false charge. And as you read through the rest of the chapter, and as you read the beginning of Genesis chapter 45, ask yourself, what stops Joseph from keeping Benjamin as he threatened to do? What's the only thing that stops Joseph? The only thing that stops him is him. The only thing that stops Joseph is that he cracks. He breaks down whenever Judah offers himself in exchange for Benjamin. He can't hold back anymore. He's been wanting to cry this whole time. He's been wanting to reveal himself. Now he can't hold it back anymore. And he finally cracks. That's the only thing that stops him. If Joseph had wanted to continue with the charge, there's absolutely nothing that the brothers could have done to stop him. And they recognize that. Right? Over the course of that episode in Genesis 44, as you read, they expect that Benjamin is going to be put to death. And they expect that the rest of them are going to become Joseph's slaves. And in fact, that's the assumption that they continually work on as they're talking with the servant and with Joseph. So what we learn from all of this is that status carries a ton of weight in antiquity. Because, again, there was nothing the brothers could have done to stop Joseph. Even though the evidence was phony, even though the charge was phony, Joseph had status and they didn't. And so the law's on his side. Several of the ancient law codes differentiate justice based on relative status. Right? Did someone of higher status do something to you? That person might have to pay a fine. Maybe. Maybe nothing happens to them. But did someone of lower status do something to you? In a lot of cases, you can have that person put to death. The laws are just codified that way. Yeah, you look at a lot of these ancient law codes, and you find different consequences for people of different relative status. But the law of Moses is different. The law of Moses explicitly says that there are not different standards and that there are not different penalties based on class. We find that most briefly stated in Leviticus 19, verse 15. You shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. But in righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. Your status is not supposed to give you a better chance at justice, right? Even for the poor. Notice how significant that is, right? The poor, as we know from our earlier studies, are economically protected, right? They have special economic status. But when it comes to matters of justice, in terms of did you commit a crime? Have you wronged this person? Or are you guilty of this, that, or the other thing? They don't have any special status. No one has special status before the law of Moses, at least in regards to that. Now, of course, we understand that there are other ways in which status can get you what you want, even if the law explicitly says status is not supposed to be a factor. We understand that status can still have an influence, especially if your status comes with wealth. We recognize that in the modern world all the time. And this is why bribes are such a big deal in antiquity, and especially in the law of Moses. Again, to find things stated briefly and simply, we can turn to Exodus chapter 23, verse 8. You shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of those who are in the right. A bribe perverts justice, and so there's to be no bribe accepted, right? No money is to be taken in matters of justice. In short, judges are not to be corrupt. They are not to judge on the basis of status. They're not to judge on the basis of some personal gain that they're going to get based on that judgment. So, according to the law, what standards are they supposed to use? I mean, obviously, you don't want them judging on the basis of status. You don't want them judging on the basis of wealth, of a bribe. So on what basis are they to judge? In the ancient Near East, there is very little in the way of what we would consider evidence in modern parlance. We have relatively sophisticated means of collecting physical evidence from crime scenes. And we use that to try to provide a more objective record of the facts. Now, obviously, the physical evidence collected at a crime scene is not going to do everything. They're kind of a safety net, as it were. Now, obviously, the ancients didn't have access to a lot of what we have. Instead, they primarily had witnesses. Now, we still rely I'd say mostly on eyewitness testimony for a lot of things. Again, the physical evidence is usually kind of a safety net. It's another layer, like an evidentiary layer. But witness accounts are still, you know, that's the primo evidence. In antiquity, it's almost the only evidence. And it is far and away the most accepted form of evidence in antiquity. Hence the importance of all of these different things we've seen, like the outcry in the rape laws, the stress placed on bearing false witness. All right, we see false witness condemned all over the law. And it's so important that it's one of the Ten Commandments. It's no coincidence, by the way, that it is false witness. Of all sins, it's false witness that leads to our Lord's being crucified. That's how powerful and evil false witness is. It is the specific crime that put our Lord on the cross. And this is why you have this constant standard repeated all throughout the law. In fact, we'll see it, I think, at some point today in our study, that there are two or three witnesses are required for capital offenses. In other places in the law, it just says all charges are to be established on the basis of two or three witnesses. So the importance of witnesses and the terrible potential of false witness gave rise to a principle that we call talionic punishment. Talionic punishment is just the principle that the wrong which you do to another should come back around to you. You should suffer that wrong. Specifically, in the case of false witness, if you falsely accuse someone of a crime, or if you bear false witness against someone and you are found out, you must bear the penalty of that crime. So let's see that demonstrated in the Law of Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 19, beginning in verse 15. A single witness shall not suffice against a person for any crime or for any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses shall a charge be established. If a malicious witness arises to accuse a person of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who were in office in those days, and the judges shall inquire diligently. And if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and the rest shall hear and fear, and shall never again commit any such evil among you. Your eye shall not pity. It shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. All right, so there we have talionic punishment expressed in its fullness. If you bear false witness against somebody else, what they would have been punished with, you are to be punished with. And it is to be done according to this basic, you know, this principle of lex talionis. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. We've seen in past classes that judgment is to be rendered at the gates of the city by the elders of the people. All right, so we're getting into now who is it that is supposed to enforce justice and where is it to be enforced? All right, this should go without saying, but police officers are they're an innovation. They're a very recent innovation. All right, the whole institution of policing is less than 200 years old, if I remember correctly. Certainly, as we find the law enforcement profession as it is today, it is a very, very modern thing. For most of history, justice was carried out either by either by some member of the king's court, or the king himself, some other representatives of the king, by military and military tribunals. What we see in the Old Testament, in the Law of Moses, is it is mostly dealt with at the local level, at the city gates, by the elders of the people in whatever town or village or city you're talking about. So we saw it with the Goel. Remember at the end of Ruth, Boaz gets the elders together along with this other redeemer, and he has this whole thing adjudicated and settled out, and the elders of the city bear witness for them. You remember also, if there's a redeemer who's not willing to raise up a son for his dead brother, the brother's widow can drag him before the elders at the gate and take his shoe off and spit in his face. We saw it with the proof of virginity. Remember, if a man marries a woman in the law and is displeased with her because of some indiscretion, and claims that she was not a virgin whenever she was married to him, then the whole thing goes before the elders at the city gates, and the bride's family has to bring out the proof of virginity and show it to the elders at the gates. We see this with cases of rebellious children in Deuteronomy chapter 21. Let's see, I don't think I put that in the slides. Where if you've got a rebellious or stubborn son or daughter, you can drag them before the elders at the gates and have them punished there, potentially even put to death. So this is the normative form of judgment in Israel. As much as can be handled locally should be handled locally. It's still handled publicly, but it is handled at the local level at the gates, by people who live there, who have a stake in that community, and making sure that justice is done in that community. And in many cases, the punishment is to be enforced by the townspeople themselves. So we see this in all kinds of occasions, instances where someone is guilty of offering a child to Molech, instances where people are guilty of following other gods, guilty of breaking the Sabbath, all kinds of things. Let's start in Leviticus chapter 20. We'll read the first five verses. Say to the people of Israel, any one of the people of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn in Israel who gives any of his children to Molech shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. I myself will set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people, because he has given one of his children to Molech, to make my sanctuary unclean and to profane my holy name. And if the people of the land do at all close their eyes to that man when he gives one of his children to Molech and do not put him to death, then I will set my face against that man and against his clan and will cut them off from among their people, him and all who follow him in whoring after Molech. All right, so you see it's the people of his clan who are first and foremost responsible for rendering this punishment. Because you see, the people that are singled out by God, if they ignore the crime, is the man's own clan. So again, everything is to be handled locally. We find this also with cases of blasphemy. Leviticus chapter 24, verse 15. And speak to the people of Israel, saying, whoever curses his God shall bear his sin. Whoever blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him. The sojourner as well as the native, when he blasphemes the name, shall be put to death. And then we find it, finally, with Sabbath breaking in Numbers 15:32. While the people of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day, and those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. They put him in custody because it had not been made clear what should be done to him. And the Lord said to Moses, the man shall be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. And all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death with stones as the Lord commanded Moses. So, the vast majority of judgment that you find in ancient Israel is to happen in this way. The trial, as it were, happens at the gates. The elders of the town are the judges and jury, basically. And the people of the town are the executioners, if an execution is warranted. Everything handled locally. For most cases. There are some cases, however, where you have to appeal to a higher authority. The law calls for priests to render judgment in certain cases. We'll start in Deuteronomy 17, verse 8. If any case arises requiring decision between one kind of homicide and another, one kind of legal right and another, or one kind of assault and another, any case within your towns that is too difficult for you, then you shall arise and go up to the place that the Lord your God will choose. And you shall come to the Levitical priests and to the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall consult them, and they shall declare to you the decision. Then you shall do according to what they declare to you from the place that the Lord will choose. And you shall be careful to do according to all that they direct you, according to the instructions that they give you, and according to the decisions which they pronounce to you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside from the verdict that they declare to you, either to the right hand or to the left. The man who acts presumptuously by not obeying the priest when he stands to minister there before the Lord your God, or the judge, that man shall die. So you shall purge the evil from Israel, and all the people shall hear and fear and not act presumptuously again. All right, so there you see a very similar language used to the laws against false witness. The one bearing false witness is to be punished. The people will see, the people will fear, they won't do it again. Same thing goes with appealing to the priest. The priest's authority in this case is to be respected. If the case is too difficult, the elders of the town take the case to the priest, wherever the house of the Lord happens to be, whether it's at Shiloh or Jerusalem or wherever, goes to the priest and has the priest render judgment. And so you're supposed to listen to the priest. Now, you saw the language of intercession in that law, right? The man who acts presumptuously by not obeying the priest who stands to minister there before the Lord your God, that man shall die. The priest is ultimately an avenue for God's own judgment. And so when we say sometimes you need to appeal to a higher authority, this is precisely what we mean. You need to appeal to the highest authority. And so in Deuteronomy 17, the judgment is understood to have been a divine judgment since it's coming from the priest. In other laws, that the divine nature of that judgment is made explicit, at least even more explicit to our ears. For example, we have the Sota ordeal of Numbers 5, or we've done classes on that in the past, so we're not going to go all through Numbers 5 again. But where a man suspects his wife of having been unfaithful to him, but he has no evidence, he can take her to the priest. The priest basically mixes up a potion, has her drink it, and God himself renders the judgment. If she's guilty, her womb falls out. If she is innocent, she will bear children. So it is a directly divine judgment. But it begins with the priest. You go to the priest. The priest is to write down the curse. The priest is supposed to mix up the potion and administer it. The priest is supposed to observe all of the goings-on. This priestly duty to judge and God's participation to render that judgment, those are displayed in the very clothing that the priest wears, in the priestly garments, in the form of two stones, what we refer to as the Urim and the Thummim. We read about them in Exodus chapter 28. Now, in Exodus 28, we get a long description of what the priest's clothing is supposed to be like. We're going to catch like the beginning and the end of that segment that's going to talk about the Urim and the Thummim. So we're going to start in Exodus chapter 28, verse 15, and then we're going to skip to verse 30. You shall make a breastpiece of judgment in skilled work. In the style of the ephod you shall make it, of gold, blue, and purple, and scarlet yarns, and fine twined linen you shall make it. Now skipping down to verse 30, and in the breastpiece of judgment you shall put the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be on Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord. Thus Aaron shall bear the judgment of the people of Israel on his heart before the Lord regularly. Right, so The Day of Atonement is alluded to in talking about Aaron going before the Lord and bearing these stones of judgment on his heart whenever he goes in before the Lord. This is the judgment of the people of Israel being on his heart before the Lord. But the whole language of this, we're meant to understand that this equipment is meant for Aaron as high priest to carry out his duties as judge. That's why it's called a breastpiece of judgment. And that's why the Urim and the Thummim are referred to as the judgment of the people of Israel. In other words, the Urim and the Thummim are the means by which the priest judges the people. The means by which God makes known to the priest what the true judgment is to be. Now, we don't know exactly how the process worked, but in some way these stones were to be cast, they were to be read in some way, so that the priest could discern what the Lord's judgment was in whatever case has come before him. So, you've got a couple of different layers of judgment given. And later in Israel's history, the king kind of becomes an additional upper layer of judgment, which is why we so often put the blame on David for things, why the histories of Israel always put the blame on the kings for some of the things that happen wrongly in the land. So you've got all these, you've got these different layers. It starts at the local level, with simple cases. More complex cases move up to Shiloh or Jerusalem or wherever, and are dealt with by the priest and ultimately by God himself. But even in cases where the authorities are not explicitly appealed to, God promises to act as judge. So God acts as the ultimate judge over every case in the Law of Moses. We find this expressed generally in the Law of Moses whenever God lays out the blessings and curses either for obeying or disobeying the law. We see it in places like Leviticus 26, where God says, look, I'm going to be watching Israel, and if you follow the law, I'm going to bless you, I'm going to do all these good things for you. If you disobey the law, if you break the law, then I am going to oppress you, and ultimately I am going to boot you out of the promised land, and you're going to lose everything. But we also find it in specific cases. For example, in Exodus chapter 22, beginning in verse 22, you shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child. If you mistreat them, and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry. And my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like a money lender to him. You shall not exact interest from him. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak in pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down, for that is his only covering. And it is his cloak for his body. In what else shall he sleep? And if he cries to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. So in all of these cases where there's not someone to stand in and make sure that justice is being done, God says, I'm going to hear. I'm going to make sure that justice is done. And so that's how justice is done under the law. All right, everything that we have seen requires obedience in order for it to work. There are so many ways that this whole system just comes crumbling down when people don't cooperate. And we've seen so many examples of it over the course of our study. We saw Joab taking Abner to the gates of Hebron and stabbing him there, corrupting justice. We saw David failing to render judgment in several cases. We saw bearing false witness. We saw the case of Naboth's vineyard, where Jezebel sets up false witnesses to accuse Naboth of blasphemy and pays off these witnesses. So we see, you know, where all of these things are commanded, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not take a bribe, you shall render righteous judgments. There's really very little enforcement mechanism beyond God himself. If somebody like Joab or David or Jezebel chooses to disobey the law, there's very little that can be done to curb their wickedness. There are so many ways in which justice can be perverted. And of course, the same is true today. It's true in the world and it's true in the church. Right, I alluded to the Me Too movement earlier in the lesson. There has been a similar unveiling of wrongdoing in church circles. I hate to slap the hashtag on it. I feel like hashtags cheapen things, but it's commonly referred to as the Church Two, TOO. At Church Two, where women have been coming out in huge numbers, talking about how they have been abused by people in the church and how it's been covered up by the people in the church who should have been executing justice, right? We at 14th know somebody who has been in that situation. Not a situation that happened at 14th, a situation that happened in another church, in another denomination, in another time and place, who has dealt with that trauma and had it covered up. And by all accounts, it is exceedingly common for people to be ignored and for the leaders in a congregation, like the preacher, like the elders, or in other denominations, a pastor or like the priest, to cover things up. Because because people in the church choose not to obey the law, because people choose to render false judgments, because people choose to accept bribes, because people are corrupt, yes, even in the church. And it ought not be so. Because look, if somebody wants badly enough to corrupt justice, it is very difficult to stop them, unless we're willing to take a very uncomfortable stand against it. And even then, we often fail. So the promise that the law gives us, and the gospel repeats this promise, is that God is just. Where our justice fails, his justice will not. He sees what's done in the dark. He sees the truth behind the false witness's lies. He avenges wrongs. He is the goel for the one who has no goel. For those who are oppressed, this is God's promise. God has got your back. The arc of justice ultimately bends your way. But for those who do the oppressing, it is his threat. We confess that we will never get things perfect in the here and now. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, right? It doesn't mean that we just kind of throw up our hands and say, well, God's going to come along later and clean up this mess. We're not going to try to immanentize the eschaton, like William F. Buckley, was it, Bill Buckley Jr. said that, right? That was his shtick. Anytime you wanted to do something good that he didn't want to do, it was immanentizing the eschaton. And we confess, we're not going to get everything perfect here. It is not an excuse to throw up our hands and not try, because we know that God will judge us based on what we do in the here and now. And so, as imperfect as our justice is, we must strive for it to be perfect. Because we know that God is coming. We know that God will judge us. Well, I hope that this entire study has been beneficial to all of you. Teaching it, I have gotten a ton of benefit out of this, going through the studies, reading the law, piecing things together. In this course, we have striven to show the history of Israel and the history of the patriarchs, because that's also the history of the church. We have striven to explain the worship of God, which he required under the law of Moses, because Jesus Christ came to fulfill that law. And his fulfillment of the law is the basis on which our own worship is built. And we've seen many, many ways in which the law that Israel offered under, the worship that Israel offered under the law teaches us about the worship that is required of us in the church today under Christ's covenant. Our study of Hebrews is going to delve further into that, by the way, into greater detail, the connection between the worship that is offered under the law and the worship that is offered in the church. Finally, we have striven to show what kind of justice God expects of mankind. Not just what we've talked about today, but what we've been talking about over the past many weeks, what the standards of right behavior are, what the heart is supposed to be like, the heart that lies behind all of our behavior, what it is supposed to be like. We learn about all of that in the law. God only wrote a civil law for one nation, and he did it for Israel. Now, we're right to say today that the religious requirements of the law of Moses have been done away with in ways that the New Testament specifies. We're talking about circumcision, talking about the dietary laws, talking about animal sacrifices, talking about, there are several things that we could name that are talked about specifically in the New Testament. Things that, in the language of Acts 15, the early church saw that it was not fit to add these burdens to Gentile believers. Right? We rightly recognize that those kinds of religious requirements have been done away with because of Christ. They're all fulfilled in Christ. But the principles behind the civil law largely have not been done away with. In fact, we see Christ amplifying them in the Sermon on the Mount. Right? When the elders in Jerusalem are writing in Acts 15 to the Gentile churches that they're not going to lay any other burdens on them, they are not releasing them from their requirements, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. They're not releasing them from that at all. Those are universal burdens. Right? That is a universal law. Things that, again, we see Christ amplifying in the Sermon on the Mount. Right? You heard it presented this way, you shall not murder. I'm telling you, you shouldn't even get mad at your brother. You shouldn't hate your brother, or you're going to bear the judgment. Whoever says you empty head, right, is liable to the hell of fire, Jesus says. When Christ gave himself on the cross, he didn't make obsolete the requirements to love our neighbor as ourselves, to promote peace, to use just weights and balances, to respect others' property, to remain sexually pure, to marry each other for life and to let the marriage bed remain undefiled, right? To care for our children rather than murdering them in the womb, to protect the widow, the orphan, and the foreigner, to forgive debts. None of that was wiped away. Secular politics is built on picking and choosing which of those requirements we're going to honor and which of those requirements we're going to make elaborate secular excuses for not honoring. What the law sets in front of us is a whole picture, a broad requirement. It says, you shall love the Lord your God. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Right? Remember, everything hinges off of that. All of those things that we listed out hinge off of those two commandments. And so, looking at this part of the law, where we have shown what kind of justice God expects of Israel and then ultimately of all of us, I hope that it moves us, because it's easy for us to get caught up in the red team, blue team nonsense that the world feeds us today. Again, where secular politics is about picking and choosing what set of principles you want to honor and what set of principles you want to make excuses for. And we are told in the Sermon on the Mount, you are to be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. So to close out the whole study, I just want to read the words of the Apostle Paul about the value of the law that we have just finished studying. But Paul's writing, he's not just writing about the New Testament. He's not just writing this about the Gospels, about the Epistles. He's writing this about all of it, the Law of Moses included. He says, all Scripture is breathed out by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, equipped for every good work. And it is my prayer that this study has helped us in doing that. That's it for now. Till next week, take care. Bye-bye.